You have found the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Hello, listeners. In this episode of the Kaleidoscope Gallery, we will be chatting with one of our regular contributors, Hans Edquist. A songwriter, music producer, and former DJ with an intriguing story. We'll hear about Hans's journey from his prolific MySpace-hosted mashups in the late 2000s to a shooting star in the club scene in Toronto and internationally under the name DJ Bartletto. And then a surreal, bizarre live show experience held under suspicious circumstances, and his subsequent retreat from burgeoning fame as a DJ and from making music at all, to an eventual reemergence that began with just an acoustic guitar and a laptop in a basement, which led to experimental and genre-blending releases under the new moniker, Beverly. And then we'll learn about his latest project, created alongside various collaborators. A series of Beverly EPs and singles devised within the backdrop of recent tumultuous global events. An artistic endeavor, over 2 years in the making. So let's get into this conversation inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery. We're joined by...
Who are we joined by?
Well, we're joined by you, and this you. Who is
who
you?
Who am I?
Who are you?
That's a question that needs to be answered.
So, Hans, you're our regular contributor to the podcast, but here we're talking about something different.
We're going deep. We're going deep into the depths.
We're here to talk about a very interesting project that you have been involved in. You're a musician and a music producer, and you have been involved.
I make music.
And you make music. That's actually the best.
I made a little bit of music.
That's the best description, I think. Yes. You have been working on a project for 2 years.
The project's been since COVID started. So I would say March of 2020.
We should tell people what artist name you release under, because you're...
So, yeah, I've been releasing music for the last, 7 years?
Yeah.
7 years? Let's say 7 years under Beverly.
And you have been releasing music, producing music for how long would you say? When was your first release as an artist?
Oh, okay. Like unofficial? Well, let's just say I got into like electronic and rave style music, I would say, in 2007, my good friend who I've always been good friends with since we met in like grade 7 and 8, we used to skate around the suburbs. He introduced me to like Justice and Mastercraft in like 2007. That music had this similar effect. It was like this, like an edgier version of like an already existing type of music, and that made me want to make it. The aesthetic was cool. They all like leather jackets, rock star kind of shit, a little bit of punk influence, but it was like twisting an already existing genre
by using electronics.
Exactly. But that was the first time I was like, before that, I was stoked on like whatever, like, you know, screamo, pop punk, skate punk, all that shit.
Guitar music
in quotations. Yeah. And then, yeah, once he showed me this, because he was like really, he's like into design and all that shit. So he's like, was a little ahead of the curve with like the music stuff. And yeah, he showed me this shit. And before they were like big or anything. And then, yeah, I just got like stoked and addicted to that aesthetic, that style of how it sounds, like the compression, this, I guess it was like the French touch kind of thing, the whole like Ed Banger records. And yeah, that just made me so excited. I wanted to learn how to make that kind of music. So My other friend, who is also like a design dude, and I think he's like living in the UK now, Matt, he bought like a MIDI keyboard. And with the MIDI keyboard, you'd get like a demo version of I think it was Ableton Live Lite 4.
Right.
So it gave me 4 wave tracks and 4 MIDI tracks.
Wow. That is really light.
Like once I learned on how to like sample stuff, like sample drums, and you could put it into like the sampler and like, and you could just.
This is Ableton's music production software.
Yeah. Oh, Ableton, big shout out.
But you had a very limited version of it though.
Yeah. No, it was very limited. Gave me such, I mean, if you look at my stems from those songs, there would be like hi-hats and bass and like in the same track. So it was chaos, but that didn't matter. It gave me a limited amount of shit to work with. And I just figured out how to like, once I learned like compression and stuff and like how to make things like sound a little more aggressive or exciting.
Yeah. Production techniques.
The floodgates fucking opened.
So you started to produce electronic music, dance music, club music.
Yeah.
Under the name, artist name, DJ, or sometimes just Barletta.
Yeah. So that name came from originally, I was on MySpace. And I was making like mashups with like 2 turntables, like straight up. I like buy acapellas and instrumentals from Play to Record. Burnt so much money while doing that shit, like vinyl. Like I used to like do scratch DJing and shit before, because my buddy who I used to do flooring with, Alex, like turned me on to like scratch records and shit. So I was making like live mashups and then like routing them into the computer and whatever. So that was those were like the first things that I made. And then I made like a MySpace for them. And it was just like, I just called it DJ Barletta because there was a skater named Louis Barletta, which I really loved. And he used to innovate and do all kinds of wacky shit. And I really, really respected that. So, and it was also just that he had that style of like, didn't give a fuck, super innovative, like, but highly talented as well. And so that's where the name Barletta came.
Huh, and so, but it must be said then we're speaking from Toronto here, and this is DJ Barletta made a splash in the electronic music dance club scene here in Toronto. Quite the splash. At one point you were kind of the talk of the town, I would say, in that scene for a brief period.
It's David King, aka The Monarch, outside of Social before Barletta's show on a Monday night. I'm really excited to talk to him. I mean, so I believe you're going on tour soon.
Yeah, totally. I got a Canada and U.S. tour as of May. As of May 12th, basically I'm gone for the month, doing 7 dates in Canada, then off for a bit, and then out to like Phoenix and L.A. and doing a couple dates in Mexico.
You're definitely one of the most electric, I can't think of another word to describe it, electric performers I've seen on stage as a DJ. When I saw you play at the Golden Girls After Party, you amped everything up to a point that no one else could really follow you up. What's your take on performing as a DJ?
Honestly, like I just like go out and like I want to, like that's my passion, is to play music for people and to get people like amped on life. And like truly and honestly, like I just want to play music, make people happy, make people just as happy as how happy I am playing. And that's like my only thing, like music, that music is my life and nobody can take that from me, and I just want to share that with other people. So that's like the gist of that.
It was one of those things where it was just the right timing. I was a little ahead of, you know, most people in the underground, because my friends had just like a better, wider sense of what was to come, like as in art and music. And because I was just some guy, blah, 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 you know, but then they showed it to me and I was like, shit, this is dope. So I wanted to create it. It wasn't the any kind of notoriety or popularity is honestly mostly just to do with timing. And then also that I was introduced to the right people.
And you were good.
Yeah, I would say I was like prolific, and I kept in the blogosphere as well as just, I wish I would shamelessly make like a bootleg remix every week.
So you mentioned the EP. I mean, I've been one of the lucky recipients of a lot of your kind of remixing. I think in pretty much every post I mentioned, you're one of the most like hardworking remixers pretty much out there on, you know, Hype Machine, the internet, etc. How are you able to actually produce, you know, on average one if not two remixes a week that generally people seem to flock to and like absorb, and like how does that feel, and how do you do it?
I guess just like practice, dude, honestly. Like I don't have a real job, so DJing is all I do, so I have a lot of free time, so that's all I can really say. But just honestly, like, I got into electro, it did something to me that I was just like, wow, this, I don't know, I just got really inspired by the music, and I longed to create that feeling again. So I don't know, it's just like, it's just in me, I guess, I don't know, and whatever, if it's a track a week or a track a month, like, I don't know, it's just truly like, it's something I got to get out of me, and it's just like, it's almost come to a regiment, but I just feel that like keeping on your game, keeping on the hype, keeping ahead of the curve, that's the only way to stay in the game right now. And I think just like the motivation right here is just to like keep on doing work, keep on like strive to being successful, and like the main reason is because I'm scared of a day job, really.
Essentially, like my first gig as Barletta was a lady in Montreal emailed me and was like, I'll give you $400 to DJ like a night. You have to find your way here. We have some place for you to stay. And I was like, fuck yeah, I can make that happen. And then it kind of just spiraled after that. I remember the first time I got on a plane to like go to BC to do a show. That was another like revelation moment. I was like, holy shit, how can I be doing this? This is crazy. It's just those moments that you have like an immense excitement and gratitude towards life being so fucking awesome. That we're at right timing. Like that's like 80% of it, to be honest, you know? Honestly, that's how I see it. But so, you know, opportunities happened, and then I got to do some other shit in the States, a little bit overseas, got to play in Seoul and Busan in South Korea, and did some shit in Australia as well.
Yeah, and
it was a good time. Yeah, had a lot time. Of fun. It was like, I don't know, 4 years maybe. Yeah, I would say like it's like a work. It was like more like working class producer / DJ. You know, it wasn't anything like. I mean, it's just such a different ecosystem. I remember I was on like MySpace and I could like message like Crookers and shit, which were like
well known DJs.
Yeah. Like they did the Kid Cudi remix, and they would respond and have you know, suggestions, criticisms and stuff of like tracks I would send them. And like there would be times where like I would send them a track. Well, this one cool instance was I did like a Beastie. I went out to the club and then came home at like 4 or 5 a.m. and then did like a Beastie Boys remix at like 5 a.m. and then finished it and sent it to Crookers, and they were like, oh, this shit's tight. And then they were playing Ottawa that night, and the next thing I know at night, my buddy, I think Matt, it was either Matt or Jordan, they called me. They're like, yo, they're playing your remix you made like 12 hours ago in the club there. And it was like, that was a cool moment too. Certain moments like that where make it exciting, or the first time you hear your song at a club from a DJ that you don't know. That's pretty cool too.
I like MySpace a lot. It's a friendly environment to me. Like, I meet a lot of new friends. It's a great place to share music, videos.
MySpace has totally changed my life. It's a place where I can just spend all day doing absolutely nothing but chatting and posting.
So, how did you get into this website?
One day I was surfing the internet, my friend told me about it, and I checked it out, and I haven't logged off for about a year and a half.
Should we say a little toast to MySpace, RIP?
Yeah, I mean, it still exists, but you can't hear any of the songs. I don't know what's wrong with their player. It shows all the songs, because I got bands on and shit on there.
Yeah.
From, like, years ago that I'd like to hear the tracks, and they're up there, but, like, you can't log in, because it's like a dead mall, man.
Yeah.
It's a dead mall in the metaverse.
Social networking website MySpace is apologizing to users after the company revealed it's lost all of the platform's content uploaded before 2016. A statement published on MySpace blames a server migration project. One tech expert online estimated that over 50 million songs from 14 million artists are now permanently deleted.
So what ended? How did Barletta end?
Barletta, okay.
Barletta Project.
Yeah. It got to a certain point in my, you know, life trajectory where things were good on paper. The rate that I was getting was good. You know, pay was good. But I was ultimately miserable. And this is coming from someone who's maybe like 25. And you're like, well, what the fuck do you know? Like, I don't know what I knew. So, and I'm not saying that I regret stopping, because I think ultimately it was good for me. It led to like more enlightening things in my life. But I would say, yeah, it peaked at a point where I remember just being miserable and not wanting. There was a show that I was, the last show I went over to the States was, I think I played like Seattle or something like that. And yeah, it was the same shit, good rate, good people. Didn't want to be there. Didn't want to do it. Didn't want to party. Didn't want to play music. Hated that kind of music, all that shit.
So you just got sick of the music.
Yeah, I mean the problem is like when I got into electronic music, there was a certain style that was popular that was aligned with what I really liked. And the thing with like electronic music is that, and I think at least as a separate sect to EDM, the culture, it metamorphosizes and the trends change a lot quicker.
More quickly. Yeah, like it's more of a fashionable.
Prior to EDM being a thing, the styles of electronic music changed quicker.
And also
like not like how it is now where it's like whatever, chain smokers, like mainstream made EDM. It still has the same
formula
format, like, yeah. Tempo structure.
That's true. It hasn't changed in like 7 or 8 years at least,
and that's not a bad thing, dude. I like a lot of those songs, and those songs are super fun. But sure. When I got into it, it was like, yeah, it was like uninhibited, no one cared, everyone was ugly, everyone was having fun, it was a good time,
and everyone was beautiful. Okay. And because I know, like, basically what happened is when electronic music had this, you know, revitalization, I would say, club music in 2007 and beyond, and then eventually moved, what it always does, is into the mainstream, because there was money to be made.
Like any trends, man.
And yeah, and when it was going through that transition, at one point, you were just like, no, this isn't resonating with me as an artist. Yeah.
I couldn't, it wasn't a sustainable kind of thing for me, because I wanted to make music that I wanted to make, and I would have to compromise. And it was like my managers would be like, oh, you got to like include this in your mixtape, whatever, this and that. But, you know, I didn't want to do like throw in like disco house, whatever. You know, it's like it's too much compromise. And at the end of the day, I wouldn't compromise. I think the last gig was the Concert for Japan gig, which it all kind of melted. It all kind of perfectly swan dived into like the abyss.
All across northern Japan, they felt it. A magnitude 9.0 earthquake on March 11, 2011. It was centered about 80 miles offshore, and tsunami warnings went up immediately.
Hey, we are Evgenen! We are looking forward to seeing you in Toronto at Concert for Japan on September 3rd. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hey, this is Orny Adams. I am the host for the Concert for Japan. This weekend, right here, Downsview Park. Right now, we're on the suspended bar. We're 80 meters above the earth, having a party with this guy. I'm going to go mount the sushi girl now.
Okay, before we leave the DJ bar, let it behind, we have to talk a little bit about that Concert for Japan. Let me set it up, because I actually was a participant in that as well.
Set the stage.
Here we go. So. I can't remember the exact date, but it was at the time when there had been a tsunami in Japan.
Yeah.
And there was a mysterious company that emerged in Toronto that wanted to have a massive concert for Japan as a way to raise funds for the tsunami.
Somehow, seemed legit.
It seemed very legit. They booked it at Downsview Park in Toronto. Downsview Park is a large concert venue, outdoor concert venue. For example, Radiohead played there, for example. So you were on the bill. I was also on the bill. I was meant to play like a kind of after party.
Yeah.
Originally, they tried to book me to play on top of this giant scaffolding.
Yeah, dude, seeing that, I mean, I've DJed on like sort of like a rising scaffold thing, like
have you?
I did that in Texas. It's weird.
Well, this one weird. Was really huge. This one was like 100 feet in the air, Hans. It was,
yeah. No, I recall. Super.
So like, I said no to
such a nightmare. Like, how is that legal?
Anyway, so okay, and you were booked for the main stage, and so one of the first signs that some things might have been going wrong is when
there were no one was there.
They told me, I got the day before, they said, like, look, there's not enough tickets being sold for the after party, so we're gonna cancel it, and you can still come and be in the VIP section and whatever. You can come in and hang out backstage. Okay, fine. So you and I are gonna go there together. We get our passes and we get driven in with the golf cart or whatever. And we look around the grounds and yeah, it's absolutely, totally empty.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go mount the sushi girl now.
Because I wanted the sushi on the naked woman, but anyway, no.
Yeah, I mean, there's sushi on the naked chick at the Concert for Japan. Yeah, I ate some sushi. That was a thing. I mean, I'm sure, honestly, I hope she was paid. I don't think anybody would do that if they were not getting paid.
So this is in the VIP section of, the artist section, where they feed you and they have acrobats. And they had like someone on a tightrope and amazing food, actually. And then they rolled someone in, a woman who was not totally naked, but virtually naked in the sushi.
They rolled her, yeah.
Placed so all in on her body. Anyway.
I don't think she was naked, though. It was like an entire like pantyhose, but for the whole body.
Oh, so it wasn't on her skin.
Like, you know, I think it was something like that.
Sure? There's photos of us.
There is. And it's probably on my Facebook.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But, actually it was Paul Oakenfold who was scheduled. He didn't even show up.
No, I think he just went into this hotel and was like, yeah. He just caught wind of the fucking shitstorm.
Yeah. And so,
like, was it a money fraud?
Well, this
was
it. So you go to play on the main stage, you hit your first track, and I never forget the scene of like six people running towards the stage, but there was only six people there, and they were probably like the daughters, sons and daughters of like the like they were probably staff members.
Yeah, most likely.
So there wasn't. How is it that a Concert for Japan put together and the stage was like beautifully done? This was all very professional, high end setup.
It was a big fucking event.
It was supposed to be
supposed to be a big event.
Like for 15,000 people or something like that. 10,000.
Yeah, imagine.
And what happened to this that not a single person showed up? Must have been, Leah says, it was just a perfect example of money laundering.
Money laundering seems, they just pulled an Ozark on him. Yeah, I think using like a fucking cataclysmic event though is like definitely your karma is pretty bad for that.
You are inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
So after you left that project behind, producing electronic music and DJ, it seems like you stopped making music altogether for a while.
Yeah. No, I vowed to become a consumer rather than a creator. I felt that I had perhaps been maybe not giving too much, but I felt an excessive sense of burnout that the pendulum needed to swing the other way. See the problem is when you're creative and creating, and if you are taking it as your life's kind of duty, is it's always kind of in the back of your head, and you're always it's like it's a blessing and a curse heavily. It's like almost equally as much each part, and I wanted that nagging feeling off of my back, which, you know, maybe if I listened to it while I was still doing DJ stuff, like I could have maybe taken it to like a next level. Possibly it was self-sabotage, and you know, like I accept that may have been the case. Absolutely. So it's a safe bet. It's always a safer bet to just look back and appreciate other people's creations, or, you know, viscerally feel those things through other people's art and shit. But at the end of the day, I wanted to make that. I wanted to make that magic. I wanted to feel that sense of accomplishment and excitement that you can only get from creating something from nothing, which is so fucking rewarding. So it was only a matter of time until I was like, yeah, I want to like start making music again. So I started very slowly, you know, not all this rave shit. I picked up an acoustic guitar, brought it back to the basics. The acoustic guitar that my parents bought for me when I was like in grade 7, that I still have today, and the action's fucked to shit. And you will murk your hands if you try to play it for more than 5 minutes. But that being said, it started with an acoustic guitar. And then I said, I need to be able to sing, so let's try to start to learn to do vocals. And that was a whole ordeal of figuring out how can I make myself sound like I'm not embarrassed by myself? Cause like, I think a lot of people have this about their voice, or when they hear their voice, they don't like what they hear. So like, I think that's pretty relatable, but just picture that, but you're singing. So like, it's even more worse, you know? So you gotta figure out, how do I sound cool? And, you know.
Is that another way of saying, like, how can I just learn how to sing?
Not necessarily. I mean, but you gotta figure out what works for you and what makes you sound cool.
Mm. Yeah, like the range.
Because I didn't know. You don't know. You could like be stretching your... Some people, it sounds good when they stretch their voice, and it's like when they strain it, that's when it sounds has character. But like, I learned that that's not the case for myself, and I need to stick between a certain range. And it started for me with an acoustic guitar and maybe being sounding a little more quiet. Because when I started, it's like, you're vulnerable. You're still scared. So for me, that was, you know, it was like a somber EP. I was like, I still wasn't comfortable in belting stuff, you know?
So this EP was called The Lows, right?
Yeah, The Lows, yeah. It was like, it was me in a basement. Just, that's it. Like, you're alone with your thoughts and stuff. And I don't know. I guess I've always kind of chosen the route of, I'd rather be alone, but I choose more often to utilize time as for self-reflection to like help make cool art. And that comes at a cost of like somewhat antisocialism. Not, but yeah, you get what I'm saying.
You're not antisocialist.
No, I'm not antisocialist.
So how did it feel then to finally be releasing music again after a few years?
No, it was good. It felt like it was a good, like, starting block, pathway.
And it was your first release as Beverly.
It was, yeah. But if you wanna let go, I'll be there right beside you, waiting for the undertow. It got so deep, don't you know? It aches through the
phone. And what did you move on to after that?
Next was a more electronic experimental record that I did with you. We co-produced it, and I think it was like, I can't remember how many songs it was, maybe like 11 or 12.
Yeah, it was a full album's length, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, it's a full album.
And we also performed it live, which
is... Yeah, we performed at the Horseshoe. It was a fucking good-ass fucking job we did with that.
Yeah, it was a great show at the Horseshoe, Toronto, Queen Street. And then I say after that album, you went solo again. Mm-hmm. Your style shifted quite dramatically when you moved much more to more heavily programmed sounds and industrial almost or heavy, like very, very heavy metal sounds.
No, it was like, it was, okay, we're going like acoustic and then experimental electronic. And then it's like, all right, let's just like make a fucking like metalcore emo record. So then that called that Lil Sphinx.
Metalcore emo.
Yeah, metalcore emo. I hadn't done that. I hadn't produced a record like that before. So like a lot of that shit's like pretty fucking mechanical, like mechanical style riffs, like industrial riffs with like programmed drums, all that shit.
Not, they're not, these electric guitars are not being played.
No.
They're being programmed on your keyboard.
Correct, yeah. I just have a laptop. I have a fucking laptop and a keyboard and a mouse and like an shitty fucking M audio box and a nice pair of monitors that Paul's dad gave me. And that kind of took me up to, at the timeline now with that release, and I think it was maybe 5 or 6 songs.
But I must say the arrangements are really quite unique for anything I've heard before. And that's what always struck me about your ability. You have a great ability to arrange in unconventional ways.
I admire you saying that because I don't see them as unconventional. But.
Not unconventional, just surprising.
Yeah, well, surprise is a good tactic to have in production.
Yeah, exactly.
It engages the listener.
Yeah.
Increases.
So unexpected twists and turns or just unconventional in the sense that was going to expect something.
Yeah.
And then you surprise them. Mm. And that's tantalizing.
Yeah. Make the senses. Tickle the senses.
So that pretty much gets us up to the time.
Yeah, that was 2019. So then it kind of took a year off. And then, as I said, COVID happened. And then I had a bunch of time off. And then I saw that video, that MGK video behind the scenes, Bloody Valentine. And it just struck a chord with me so deep that watching that video alone propelled me to like write the body of work that I've written up until now. And I didn't know what it was going to be, EP, album, whatever. I say possibly like an EP, but there's a lot of songs there. And honestly, the focus is just like writing. I just want to write a better song after I wrote the next song.
You want to just keep improving.
That's all it is.
A unique thing about this body of work, as you call it, is that you collaborate with quite a number of people, different people.
Yeah. Well, because COVID happened, all the touring musicians had to find new hustles. So so this one place created this website called Featured X, where you could get a feature from an artist that you like. So I fucking love The Dangerous Summer. AJ Perdomo was an incredible musician, incredible singer. So I got him on I think it's like 5 songs.
So he was in, what band was he in?
He's in a band called The Dangerous Summer, which I've been a fan of, honestly, I'd say since 2010. It's very much like this happens all the time in like hip hop. It's just like now it's rock's turn because they can't tour. So they have to, you know, so it's kind of supplement
like
the income.
It's not like that one app where you can get like relatively famous people to say hello to you for like relatively
cheap. In a way, it is like Cameo. You're talking reference and Cameo. It is in a way. And some people say, oh, you know, it cheapens music, whatever. It cheapens the artist's reputation. Like, I do this shit for me so I can make something that's exciting. And all those other, you know, critiques or whatever, that ultimately doesn't matter.
So you got to work with someone that you had already admired from afar, and then you get to start working with them. So
and that the music,
and he did an amazing job, by the way. So AJ, what's his name again?
AJ Perdomo.
So yeah. He sang on how many of these songs?
I think, honestly, I think it's 5. It's at least 5 that we've done together over the last 2 years. And he's always been great, always brought like 100% to his verse, and I've never had an issue. And never made him like redo anything.
And sometimes these songs are often yourself singing, trading off, either duetting or trading off against, with another artist. And also you collaborated with Jess Dunn.
But it's too late now, 'cause I'm finally okay on my own. I'm finding it okay letting go, 'cause you're the only one who feels like home. When you're standing in the dark alone, waiting for a light to
Yeah. So she's been in the picture for a long time. Like, we've been friends for a long time. I want to say since, at least since 2013. Yeah, 2014 maybe. So yeah, I don't know, maybe 7-8 years, whatever that is. Yeah, so we've done music together in the past a whole bunch. And so she came over and she sang on, like, I think it's like three songs. And yeah, she's rad.
Yeah, she's a great singer.
Yeah. It comes together fast too. Like, that's the thing, like, when you're collaborating with people and you're in that moment in the spot, your brain's like firing just so much more faster, or at least like mine is, and just like hypercritical idea, kind of like synapses firing off. We come up with the shit quick. That's how it should be. And for me, at least, when I'm working with someone in a studio, it needs to come quickly. And
you've got to be efficient, but also what you're talking about is almost like
very, be very present.
As also not maybe like, you know, think too hard about things. You have to kind of adapt to the moment. And
yeah, it's all about adapting.
One of the songs you played for me features a saxophone solo.
Mm. Dude.
And that A is quite unique these days.
Hey man, so I got like a Russian dude on Fiverr to do one for like $10. It was legit. He did like an okay rendition, but I had to like splice it and chop the shit out of it to make it sound dope.
Yeah, and it is another example of a nice little delightful surprise, because you did not expect a sax solo coming.
It's a good one.
And you know, I often these days have been listening to a lot of music from the 1920s and 30s. For some reason, I'm just fascinated with it right now. And in this kind of music, there's all sorts of instruments that are like the main feature that you'll never ever hear again.
Yeah.
Such as muted trumpets are just absolutely massive in the 20s.
That's what I'm saying. Like the BBC, like, symphony orchestra pack that I got for free. Oh dude, it's so good.
Yeah, that is a good one.
It's all those instruments are so in the right context.
These are samples for your so that you can play them on your keyboard. You can play violins and cellos.
Cellos, like shit if you want to make movie scores or whatever, but like just like in the right context, just throw it in. It just brings so much body and emotion.
Well, I've got an idea for you potentially. One of the things that has disappeared from recorded music seems to be whistling.
Yeah. Just throw a metalcore solo with like the Yodel Kid. Just do that. Yeah, or like Tiny Tim, like fucking through with auto tune on a trap beat. Let's go.
Oh, what about this, Hans? What about the classic, like, fade out? You know when the record just kind of fades out?
Yeah, that song has that. The saxophone song does have a fade out. But no key change. No, I did. It has a fade out, too. Because I'm just like, it's such a vibe. Like, it just goes, it's just off into the sunset. But I don't think I've ever released a song that has a fade out. But this one has a fade out.
Oh, finally.
It seems appropriate. I'm just putting in like the effort, like how someone will go to the gym. And after I try every day to like, and this has been going maybe for the last 3 months or so, that like every day I gotta show up and I gotta like make shit happen. And it's amazing what happens when you show up. Like when you keep pushing and you keep showing up and you keep pushing past that point of tiredness. I get home from work, I'm tired, I want to nap, put on the DAW, you know, start making some whatever. And it's like, it's whatever at first and it kind of flops a little bit, and you know, but then it's like, if you just hold off a little bit and you just stay there in that moment and you keep just moving a little forward and kind of just trudge forward a little bit, you'll start to hit these eureka moments. That is the infinity moment that I love, is just before you want to give up, you don't, you go on. And this has happened to me multiple times. When you hit that point, I don't want to fucking be here. I want to just relax and like just vegetate. You go like another 10, 15 minutes and then you just, and then you start, things start to happen. It's not even like you, it's like the spirit of intention works through you. So this is the flip side. If you're willing to go that deep, the flip side to that is like, it's like, it does weird things to your mind. And the way that you interact with reality, for me at least, because when you go into something so the minutia of things, doesn't matter what you're doing, and you're going and you're just like, you hone it and you get so far deep in, you start to like get into that zone and that becomes like a normal. So you're working in that kind of very magnified space. So when you get out of it and then you have to deal with like real world interactions and stuff, things seem more jarring than they like are, because your lens is so sensitive, because it does make you unhinged, because things fuck you up
so like,
a lot more. So I mean,
if you're living
to me, at least
I find this, that whenever I'm focusing on mixing music, obviously outside noise becomes much more irritating.
Yeah, prevalent.
And it can be hypersensitize you to certain things.
Yeah, it's like, if you ever had a phase where like you were into graffiti, I got a slight phase where I was into graffiti.
Like making graffiti?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Just like doing graffiti. And then like, because you do it, or like skateboarding. If you skate, you'll see skate spots like everywhere. Or you'll see graffiti. You just see it more, right? So kind of just your lens becomes so, just like everything becomes an opportunity
to skate on, or to graffiti on, or to record, or to sound to use to produce with.
Yeah, things become options rather than just like nebulous, just real kind of reality. But yeah, that's the problem with, just try to craft your shit really great, is that it does have the opposite swing where like you kind of become a little unhinged. Which is like, it's just dancing the razor's edge. But that's like the artist thing. And that's why people admire artists. It's because they're willing to like go down those rabbit holes. And that's why fucking that exists, and why like art and culture exists, and why it's like a necessity. It's just, you know.
I'm wondering if we should explore more this, you said spirit of intention, and as a kind of the secret sauce for pushing, forgetting, what can you elaborate a bit?
It's like when you've got like the metal, the forgers forging in the fire.
Yeah,
it's hot.
Yeah,
and it's uncomfortable. Yeah, but that's where you're like, that's where the character is formed. That's where that part of you that people gravitate towards, because it's so like, you just like are going in all in. And you are exposing yourself, but you're becoming like refined at the same time. So it's this vulnerability, jump off the deep end, but also by doing that so many times, you become like it's like you become more of like a diamond, I guess, you know, you're chiseling that shit away.
You have been listening to the many colors of the Kaleidoscope Gallery.